We're continuing our study tonight in the book of John. We're in John chapter 11. And we're going to continue looking at the first 16 verses of John chapter 11. And as I mentioned last week, we're winding down Jesus' ministry. We've gotten halfway through the book, but the latter half is going to deal with probably, I would say, about 3 months of Jesus' life. And one set of chapters in particular are going to deal with one night. So it's going to get a lot more detailed and a lot more succinct than where we have been so far. I do want to mention that tonight we're going to be looking at some things that might be of discrepancy to some people. What I'm going to present is my opinion on the subject. It's a little hard to discern from the scriptures if we're talking about the same story, the same thing. If you have an opinion that goes in a different direction, that's fine. I'm just going to share with you what I believe the story to be as pertains to the scriptures that are applied. But it might, you might have learned it or studied it a different way, and that's okay. When we look at where we're at right now, Jesus has already given us certain things that have defined who he is. When he fed the crowd, he showed that he is the bread of life. When he healed the blind man, when he took care of the woman who was brought forth for adultery and forgave her of her sins, we see that he is the light of the world. Now we're going to see that he is the Redeemer, that he has a purpose, that he has come to save man from its sins, provided you believe in him and you call upon his name, which has been really the thrust of his entire ministry. Because something is near. What is near? What does he keep saying is near? The kingdom. The kingdom of heaven is at hand. From the very beginning of his ministry to the very end of his ministry, those are bookended comments that he makes to show that the kingdom is near. This particular miracle that we're going to talk about tonight, I do not believe is a parable. It starts out by saying a certain man. The last time we saw a phrase, a certain man, is when he is talking about the rich man and Lazarus. They are, I don't believe, the same person. But I do believe that this is a very real story, as the rich man and Lazarus story is a very real story. So this miracle points to the deity of Christ. We're going to see something that is much different than the prophets would have been involved with. While there was resurrection in the Old Testament, I brought this up a few months ago, there were only three occasions of resurrection in the Old Testament for very specific reasons. But they had not seen that type of miracle in this day and age. So Jesus is doing something that they would be kind of novel for them. It's new for them. And unfortunately, it's because of this that they finally purpose in their hearts to take him down, if you will, and to kill him. Okay, so before we begin, let's go ahead and go to our Heavenly Father in prayer. Aaron, could you lead us in a prayer tonight?
Father, we pray that you will bring them back to us, Father.
Amen. Thank you. Okay. When you think about what John is doing, I would say that John has been presenting Jesus in such a way so that you might believe. He has given us ample evidence, ample witnessing of what Christ has done and who Christ is to point all of us to the fact that Jesus is the Son of God. Not only is he the Son of God, he's the only begotten Son of God, one that's been set for a purpose, and that in believing in him, you will have life in his name. And that's really the thrust of the stories. And it's interesting to me that they couldn't get it. They just couldn't wrap their arms around it. This particular miracle here, as I said, is sort of the penultimate miracle, but it is not the last miracle that Jesus performs before his death. Do you remember what he does in the garden?
Restores
the ear of Malchus. It's a minor story. I mean, it's sort of when you hear about it, he just reached down and he, put his ear back on him. I don't know. Obviously not the same as raising somebody from the dead, but but nonetheless, it was a miracle. Yeah, I'm sure he was. Yeah. Yeah, well, as I mentioned last week, the name Lazarus means Eleazar in Hebrew, and it is a very common name, just like the name Mary is a very common name at this time. It actually is a derivative of the Hebrew word Miriam. So if you go back and look at a Miriam that you might think of in the Old Testament, I can think of one, very specific one, the one who helped with Moses, was sort of related to him a little bit. Okay, so let's go ahead and start with, we're going to read verses 1 and 2. And let's see here. Eric, could you read verses 1 and 2 for me?
Absolutely. John 11, 1 and 2. Now a certain man was sick, named Lazarus of Bethany, the town of Mary and his sister Martha. It was that Mary which anointed the Lord with ointment and wiped his feet with her hair, whose brother Lazarus was sick.
Okay. A certain man named Lazarus, we've talked about that, from Bethany. There are two Bethanies in this area. The first Bethany is right outside to the east of Jerusalem, about 3.1 kilometers. And that is where Lazarus, Mary and Martha lived. The other Bethany is on the east side of the Jordan, and it is where Jesus went after he left the crowd in chapter 10. The Bible tells us that he went to the place where John the Baptist had started his preaching and baptizing, and that is the location. I believe it's John 1:28 that gives us the name. And so it can get a little confusing because we're going to see Bethany. Well, they're not in the same place in this story. Jesus is in a different Bethany in a different place. And it's quite a distance from the Bethany where Mary, Martha, and Lazarus are at. In verse 2, it says, this Mary, so he's going to qualify, which Mary, because again, Mary is a very common name. We have Mary Magdalene. We have Mary, the mother of Jesus. We have Mary, the wife of Clopas, who was at the foot of the cross. So there's different Marys that are talked about in the scriptures. So he wants to qualify who this Mary is. He says, it was that Mary who anointed the Lord with fragrant oil and wiped his feet with her hair, whose brother Lazarus was sick. Okay, so I brought this question up last week. When did this happen? We know the story, but when did it happen?
Before Christ was at their house.
Okay. A little vague, but yes. Turn over to chapter 12. Chapter 12, starting in verse 1. Then 6 days before the Passover, Jesus came to Bethany, where Lazarus, who had been dead, whom he had raised from the dead. Then they made him a supper, and Martha served, but Lazarus was one of those who sat at the table with him. And Mary took a pound of very costly oil of spikenard, anointed with the feet of Jesus, and wiped his feet with her hair, and the house was filled with the fragrance of the oil. Okay, so John just mentioned in chapter 11 something that doesn't happen until chapter 12. Any thoughts on that? Okay. So in John chapter 11, he's not in Judea yet. He's still up in a different area. He's actually in the area of Decapolis, which is on the other side of the Jordan. Yo.
Chapter 12 defines for us that this occurred after Christ had raised Lazarus from the dead. When you look at all of the evidence that we see, John is writing this after all of this has occurred. All of the events have occurred. After Christ has been crucified and resurrected, that's when John is writing his epistle, his gospel. So as John is thinking back and remembering these things and the Lord is revealing them to him, it's for me rather easy to see that they kind of all run together. He's explaining to us who this Mary is, who this Lazarus is, and the events that show their importance in the life of Christ. That's one viewpoint. And the other viewpoint is just simply that time has no bearing as far as God's concerned.
Okay.
James, I was thinking that it's kind of a preamble to the event that happens, because as we read down further, when you see where it says a certain man, and then that certain man is one whom Jesus loved. Well, he had to have a relationship with that man before he could love him. And it seems to me that he's telling the story back in the concept that Jesus has met Lazarus, knows Lazarus, has a relationship with Lazarus, and is building the story a little bit that way for these people to be able to understand.
Okay.
Just a guess.
I would say that that's all of those ideas are where I would go with this. When you think about storytelling in the old days, and I brought this up in Intertestamental, historians today are very specific. They have to have very specific time frames, very specific actions, and they try to be as accurate to that as possible. Historians in Jesus' day and those before and after were more about the story itself than the chronological placement of that story. But if you think about it, a good storyteller, these stories would be communicated quite quickly throughout the land. This is Jesus doing these things. So it wasn't something that was hidden from the people. It would get communicated very quickly. And as Gil pointed out, John, if you're a late dater, maybe 60 years later, is writing his gospel to a group of people or to a world that had already heard these stories. And so when he's writing, he's saying, you know, Charles, we're going to talk about Lazarus. I want you to know here's what happened. And oh, by the way, the Mary we're talking about, remember that other story that I told you about some other time or that you heard about before? That's the same Mary. So it's really kind of just an idea of bringing this together. But there's a third aspect. There's a third aspect that could be this story in some form or fashion happens in the Synoptic Gospels. You see this story in Mark, you see it in Matthew, you see it in Luke, you see it in John. And we're not going to get into the detail of it because I'm going to save that for chapter 12. But there's some possibility here that they had already heard it because of the letters that had come out from Mark and Matthew. Now, Luke, I will tell you, this is where my opinion comes in, is not the same story. It's a different time period. It's a different placement. It's a different outcome. But when you look at Matthew's story and you look at Mark's story and you look at the similarities between Matthew and Mark and John, it looks very similar. The difference is that Matthew and Mark don't identify the name of the woman, but they do identify where the house is and where they're staying. John identifies the woman, but doesn't necessarily say the house. It says that he is with them, but there's all kinds of circumstances that could be here. So I don't want to go into that really in detail tonight, but those are your options that are out there. So there is no controversy here by virtue of the fact that John mentions her in verse 2 of chapter 11 when he goes into the full detail of the story in chapter 12. They're both very accurate, and they're both very real to the point. You just have to take it in context of when he wrote, what they would have known, so on and so forth, okay? A couple of other things that you're going to see. If you do go back, and I encourage you to do so, go back and find it in Matthew and Mark and Luke. It's in Luke 7. But if you go back and look at it, if you look at Matthew and Mark's account, you're going to see a couple of differences. One of them says that his head was anointed. The other one says feet. Okay? There's a different dialogue that might occur. But we will look at this in detail when we get to chapter 12, because I think it's important, because this is one of those areas where people are like, well, see, the Bible it contradicts itself, because here's four stories and all four of them got it completely different. And there are some significant differences in it, but there are reasons for it, because it's not the same story. So that's something I want you to think about when you're looking at the Gospels. Go ahead. Correct. And that's one of the things that I,
and
yeah.
She wound up wiping yeah. his feet. We have to be careful that we don't make assumptions based on our preconceived
right.
conclusions.
Right.
Read it for what it says, take it for what it says.
It's important to do that, and it's important to look at it that one writer might have a detail that another writer doesn't. That means that detail didn't happen. It just means that this writer just chose not to put that detail into their story. Charles.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Right. Exactly. It's very, and Brady could probably talk about this more than I can, as far as people's recollection of things. And how many of you have sat with your siblings and around a table when you're adults and they're telling stories and you're like, that's not what I remember. That's not the way things were. It was completely different. I know I've gone through that, and you might have too.
Mm-hmm. And how it comes up.
Yeah. Okay. So any thoughts about this particular verse here? Okay. So as we get into this, we're going to see, if you still have your question sheet from last week, and Janetta reminded me that we'd already gone through some of this, but I'll just go over it again. This story here that we're about to unfold is going to show the coming together of his humanity and his deity. His humanity and his deity. And we're going to see that because we see an emotional, troubled soul, spirit, I think is the way the scriptures say it, with Jesus. But yet we see the goodness of who he is and the deity that will be manifested as well. Okay, Charles, could you read 3, 4, and 5 of John chapter 11? Yeah. Okay, we'll just stop right there. Okay, so the very first one is the sisters. They obviously knew where he was. Again, remember what I just said. Jesus was well known, and so people who were really in belief of him had connection to him. And so they knew where he was at. Now, whether directly, indirectly, I don't know, but they obviously were able to send word via a messenger to him, and the messenger was able to find him. So there was a knowledge of where he was at in some way, some form, some fashion. So the messenger goes to Jesus and presents this message. Rabbi, Lord, teacher, behold. And that word behold there in Greek is actually listen. Listen. You whom you love, or the man whom you love is sick. Now, to Eric's point, we don't see a lot of story here about a relationship between Jesus and Lazarus where we would have gotten to this point. The word love here is the same word that Jesus uses when he references his love for John, the disciple. The disciple whom Jesus loved, Lazarus whom Jesus loved, that word is phileo. Okay? That affectionate, brotherly, you know, get together and have that moment with that person. And so the messenger doesn't say, please come, please heal him, please do something. The message from the sisters is, I just need you to know that Lazarus is sick. The person you love is sick. Now, you can imply maybe that they're trying to sort of say, this is why we're telling you this, because you need to maybe come down here and spend some time with him. But we don't see that in context. All we see is that this person, Jesus had a very fond, affectionate, brotherly connection to, like he did John the disciple. Okay, same word used. When Jesus heard this, he says, the sickness is not unto death. What does that mean? The sickness is not unto death. Okay, but he died. Yes, that's the point. Is that, yes, he is going to die, but it's not going to keep him in that state. The sickness is not unto death, but for the glory of God, that the Son of God may be glorified through it. Well, we've heard that before. Where did we hear that before? Healing the blind man. Same thing, right? And so the thought process was, well, who sinned? The parents or the blind man, so that he's in this state? And then other people thought, well, maybe he was blinded at birth so that God could use this moment to manifest the glory. I don't think that that's the case any more than Lazarus died to show the glory of God. Jesus is using this opportunity to prove a point, to make something happen because of the death of Lazarus. Yeah.
As you go back and look at chapter 9 with the blind man, we don't see the indication where Christ, he does say this is for God's glory, but here he makes an addendum to that.
Correct.
He said this is for God's glory, that the Son of God, the terminology which would define him as God, would be glorified in this also.
Yeah, that last part there is different than what's in verse 9, but the idea is the same. All of his works have been about the glory of God. But the difference here is because this has a representation in his action and what he is going to go through, it's a little bit different because of the miracle, and the application of it is different than what he did with the blind man, the bread, the water, all those different things. Charles? So I thought about that too. Yeah, I thought about that too. Yeah, and I think you could apply it that way from a spiritual standpoint. But obviously, we're seeing this in a very physical, very real sense. But I kind of thought that too when I read it, that you could apply that to a spiritual side as well. Okay. Now, Jesus loved Martha and her sister and Lazarus. Okay, so we have stories about Martha, and we have stories about Mary. This word loved here is not the same word that he used when was talked about, that was used with him when talking about Lazarus being sick. This word is agape, or it's a derivative of agapeo, which means unconditional love. Now, there is a tie-in between what he just said about the glory of God and the Son of God being glorified through it, and his love for Martha and her sister and Lazarus. And that tie-in comes together in the very next verse, when it says, so when he heard that he was sick, he stayed two more days in the place where he was. The Greek nuance here is therefore. In other words, it's purposeful. It's not just a, let me finish up a few things that I got to do around the house and got to, you know, pack up the donkey and get everybody ready to go and, you know, make sure everything's taken care of. This is a purposed reason to stay behind. And the reason for it is the verse that he just said. So that the glory of God, but for the glory of God, that the Son of God may be glorified through it. So that's the reason why he's doing what he's doing in verse 6. Okay? Now, he knows that Lazarus is going to die. There are speculations as to how he would know this. I think it's very easy for all of us to say he has that divine nature. He knows these things. He's connected to nature. Therefore, when there's a disruption in nature, he would know these things. And so he knows that this is going to happen. He purposes to stay behind two more days. Now, there's a lot of speculation as to why he's waiting this amount of time. If you know Jewish history, the Jews, and you brought it, and Gil brought this up, I think it was in one of your sermons, you were talking about death. The Jews believed that the soul would remain over the body for 3 days. So technically to them, if someone raised up from the dead, and it was within that 3-day period, they were never really dead to begin with. So there's purpose behind the 4-day aspect. Because in that 4th day, now you're talking about someone who has passed that Jewish lore, and the smell, the rigor mortis, all that kind of stuff is going to set in at this point in time. So there would be no question to anybody who witnessed this that Lazarus was indeed deceased. Okay? All right, any thoughts about through verse 6? Okay. Mike, could you read 7, 8, 9, and 10?
And then he said to his disciples, "Let us go back to Judea." "But Rabbi," they said, "a short while ago the Jews there tried to stone you, and yet you are going back?" Jesus answered, "Are there not 12 hours of daylight? Anyone who walks in the daytime will not stumble, for they will see by this world's light. It is when a person walks at night that they stumble, for they have no light."
Okay. All right, so this is another reason why we know that the Bethany he is at is not in Judea, because they clearly say you're wanting to go back to Judea. So remember, Judea is the region where Jerusalem is at. He is not in that region. He is outside of the region. The disciples then said, they're going to kill you. They're wanting to stone you. But Jesus doesn't address and answer that question or that statement. He goes into a completely different statement. And this is one of the most profound statements that the Lord makes in his ministry. Are there not 12 hours in the day? To a Jew, there were always 12 hours in the day. It didn't matter where the sun was at. It didn't matter if it was summertime or if it was wintertime, where you had shortened days in the winter, long days in the summer. Their days were always manifested around 12 hours. So you had 12 hours a day and you had 12 hours in the evening or the night. And so the point he's making here is that there is a duty to be had. And that duty is done while you are still alive, while the light is still present. And when you are purposed to do God's will, you only have a fixed time to do it, from the time of your birth to the time of your death. Again, think Jewish. For some people, that might be 95 years. Other people, it might be 30 years. Others, it might be 65 years. It's still a fixed time period, just like the Jews had a 12-hour fixed time. And so he makes the comment that if anyone walks in the day, in other words, if anyone is doing the will of the Father, if anybody is working in the light, you're not going to stumble because you are purposed in that way to work. You see the work. You see what God is doing. You see the word in front of you, and you go out and you work. But if you walk at night, you can't see anything. You can't be attached to that. And it's a double meaning here. The first meaning is that the comparative to the light and dark is comparative to living and dying. But the other side of it is to living and dying to sin. That if you're in the light, if you're in Christ, you're walking with Christ, it's a fixed period of time that that's going to happen. But then eventually that's going to go away. And either you're going to be dead to sin, or you're not going to have access to that light anymore because the light's going to be taken out of the world. So there's all these different little things that go on here. But the one that really got me the most was this idea of the fixed time. And that's really important because we don't know when our life is going to end. So the idea is work. Don't worry about that endpoint. Just work. Do what you can, because you only have a certain amount of time that you can do that in. Now, this is, again, one of those opinion areas. I know other people might see this differently. I did a lot of study on this, and this was the one that sort of made the most sense to me. But the point that Christ is making here is that he has a purpose to do, and his purpose is to bring light into the world, and eventually that light is going to be taken out of the world because he's going to die. And so he needs to do what's necessary to show the light and show the things that he can while it is still his time to do so, because that time is fixed. Eventually, he is going to go to the cross, and he is no longer going to be doing those things because he's not going to be in the world. Okay? So you can take it in many different ways. The light and darkness aspect comes up in so many different ways. Jesus even uses it in the idea of being alive and dead in a physical sense. Okay, so I'll open it up. I know there's probably some thoughts there, but please feel free. Okay. All right. Gil, could you finish up 11 through 16? Okay. So verse 11, these things he said, and after that he said to them, our friend Lazarus sleeps. Okay, so by virtue of using the phrase our friend, we can deduce that this man is somebody that they were familiar with as well. That Lazarus has been involved with Jesus to some point where the other disciples were aware of him. And so he says he sleeps. Now, this term, sleeps, we've seen a lot, right? Throughout the scriptures. And it's always used in reference to someone who is righteous. It was not used to somebody who was unrighteous. So what's the implication? If it's used to someone who's righteous and the term is to sleep, what is implied there?
That they thought that person was righteous.
Okay, that they thought that person was righteous. Right. Now, technically speaking, we all will sleep and we all will be awakened and we will all have judgment and we will all be dealt one way or the other based on that judgment. But the point here is that those that are sleeping in Christ will arise and awaken and be connected to the Father in a heavenly sense once that final judgment day occurs. So, he says he sleeps, but they didn't understand, as usual. They didn't get this. And he goes, I've got to go wake him up. Well, they're saying exactly what I would say. Well, if all he has to do is wake up, just let him wake up. You're going to go all the way down there, drag us all the way down there with you. You're going to put yourself at risk, which means you're going to put us at risk just so you can wake him up. Obviously, they didn't understand. Jesus spoke of his death, but they thought that he was speaking about taking in rest and sleep. Then Jesus just flat out told them, he's dead.
They didn't understand, but I think it's important that we have compassion for them. We got the story.
Yeah.
We know what's going on. We know how this ends. We know what the verbiage is. This is all very old to us in many ways. Not to them.
Yeah.
And so they don't get it. And frankly, I think if we were there, we wouldn't have got it either.
I couldn't have said it better, Brady. We talk about the Old Testament that way too. Well, if I had seen the pillar of fire and the cloud and the man and the quail, I wouldn't feel the way they did. But no, we probably would have felt the same way. Okay. So Lazarus is dead. Now, again, I believe it's his divine nature that tells him this. Because when the messenger came, Lazarus wasn't dead. He was ill. So the messenger comes, says, Lazarus is ill. Jesus waits two more days, says, okay, we got to go. Tells his disciples, we're going to be heading out, and he tells them he's dead. So somewhere along the way, he knew that Lazarus had died. Eric and then Gil.
Well, yeah, I think he knew that, but I was going to make this comment earlier, is that Jesus understood it was God's time, not his time. Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting because I was reading through commentaries and they're trying to give you all the points of faction there. And I'm thinking, yeah, there really isn't any faction there for me. It's very clear. But it's obvious that there's a lot of people who do feel that way. That this isn't, there wasn't a way that Jesus could have known. He had to have heard through the grapevine somehow that Lazarus had died.
Why do people question?
There are lots of different reasons. And so we're going to segue into what you just said. So the story is for various reasons. You've got the glory of God, the glory of the Son of God. You've got the love that he shows towards Mary, Martha, Lazarus. You have the belief that he is continuing to instill in those that are following him. So there's a lot going on here, but ultimately what Jesus is doing is showing that he is the Lord of the resurrection as well. He's the Lord of everything, but now he's coming to that ultimate point to say, I'm the Lord of the resurrection. Which is interesting because he doesn't actually resurrect himself from the dead. But he is the Lord over death. Because in his death, in his resurrection, death was conquered. The sting was taken from Satan. And so he is that person when it comes to our relationship with God. We have to have that Lord of resurrection in front of us so that we too can go through that process. Okay, so number four in your sheet, the account is given to show us, and I just said it, to show us the glory of God, the glory of the Son of God. To show us that he is the Lord of the resurrection. So this is the final, supreme, incomparable, undeniable proof that he is Jesus the Christ. Now, I'm not saying that there's nothing that's going to be more magnificent than this, but the point is that when we get to the cross, we see a very physical situation occurring. Torture, suffering, pain, death. And that's not the same as him performing a miracle in such a way where he is raising somebody from the dead. The question I have for you, though, is this the first person he has raised from the dead in his ministry? Any thoughts? Raised the daughter of Jairus. What else? There was the funeral procession for the widow, and he was in Nain, and there was another miracle there of raising from the dead. Huh? The widow's son, yeah, sorry. The difference, though, is these were set up a little bit differently. They're very close to when it happened. He's in the area. There's a much different process here than what we're going through with Lazarus and what's happening here. But Charles, back to your point, I think one of the reasons why I like this story in a spiritual sense is because it's showing us that we don't die in our sickness to death when Christ is there to raise us from that sickness. And we don't see that in the other times that he raised somebody from the dead. This is very specific. So I really think there is a spiritual connotation here to show that.
I'm sorry, why is that not in the other?
We don't know. We doesn't say. It's just a very small scripture, but it gives us no context. There's no setup to it. There's no other understanding of it other than he just did this. But this one, he takes time. There's dialogue. There's structure. There's a story with a point that takes up an entire chapter to this process, because this is the culmination of everything that he's been teaching them, and we're getting ready to go into the Passover week.
Think of it in terms of this one's person. Jairus' daughter, the widow, said, and Jairus comes to him and says, my daughter's sick, you know, you need to come. And then the servants come and say, hey, she's dead. Mm-hmm.
But it's also personal from a spiritual standpoint, because these were...
Yeah, I wasn't discounting the spiritual.
Right, right.
But this is personal. And
right,
physical,
right.
It,
absolutely.
That's
absolutely, it's a friend.
We take and make the application in the personal, spiritual. And it's, I think it's the proper application.
Yeah. So I think, Brady, that's the difference between the stories. Okay. So there are seven miracles listed in John. This is the seventh. Actually, there's eight if you take Malchus's ears being a miracle, which it is. So we had the turning water to wine. We had the healing of the nobleman's son. Restoring the impotent man. Multiplying the loaves and the fish. The walking on water. Giving sight to the blind man, and giving life to a dead man. Okay, and we'll just go down to verse 16 real quick. Then Thomas, who was called the twin, said to his fellow disciples, let us also go that we may die with him. Interesting point here. Thomas is Aramaic for twin. Didymus is Greek for twin. So John's making it very clear that this guy is a twin. The him is Christ. Yeah. He's not talking about Lazarus. He's talking about. And the interesting part about this is because this is the same guy who walks away or runs away from Jesus in the garden. And then when Jesus is resurrected, doesn't believe that it actually happened. But he's willing to go to battle here. So just...
Did you get to this, Thomas, into service in some ways? First of all, he shows amazing courage here.
Yes, he does. I agree. We call him Doubting Thomas, but yeah, yeah. Right. Or Christian killer to Paul, you know. Yeah, we tend to keep that in front of us. It's like Benedict Arnold. He's always going to have a certain aspect to him, even though there was another completely different part of who he was. Yeah. So okay, all right. So we're gonna continue on. Oh, Eric, did you have a comment?
Oh, I was just going to say we've kind of glossed over something because the messenger who brought the message to Jesus that Lazarus was sick went back and knew that Jesus was going to delay and had to tell them. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and that's again part of the point. So, yeah, it's I love these stories because we can see that, as I think you said, it's in God's time, it's God's way, it's purposed for a reason and for an outcome, and so we see that throughout this particular chapter. So, okay, I will have questions for you for next week for the next half, and I appreciate your time this evening.